In this hour of Focus, we'll be talking with disability rights activist Laura Hershey. She is an advocate, a writer, a poet. She works as a consultant to organizations who are interested in improving their efforts to serve people with disabilities and to increase accessibility to implement the Americans with Disabilities Act. She has many years experience both as an activist, as a consultant, and a journalist. At the moment, she is advocacy editor of SpineWire, which is a website that has news and features and articles dealing with various issues, various disability issues. Also, it's a place that people can find products to assist in daily living. She's been involved in many different organizations. Just to mention one, she was for a time director of the Denver Commission for People with Disabilities, and also worked as an accessible housing specialist with the Denver Commission for People with Disabilities. She's received a lot of recognition for her work, including in 1999, the President's Award from the President's Committee on Employment of People with Disabilities. Currently, she's spending some time on the U of I campus as guest in residence at Allen Hall as part of the Unit 1 program. And she's been good enough to make some time and talk with us here this morning. She's joining us by telephone from Allen Hall. As we talk with Laura Hershey, you should feel free to be part of the conversation. Anyone who's listening is welcome if you'd like to call. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That means if it would be a long-distance call for you, use that number. We'll pay for the call, 800-222-9455. And another way to think about it, you match the letters and the numbers on the phone, you get WILL. So 333-WILL and toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Ms. Hershey, hello.
Hello.
Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
I thought maybe we might talk a little bit about the Americans with Disabilities Act, just to start.
Okay. I also just want to correct one thing.
Oh, yes, ma'am.
You had some old information there. I'm no longer the advocacy editor with SpineWire. I'm now back to freelancing as a journalist.
Ah, all right.
So.
Well, we'll see. That's still, I think probably that's a good place if people are interested in exploring disability issues. It's probably a good place to start.
It no longer has the emphasis on news and advocacy that it did. There are still products and a little bit of news.
Okay.
So.
Very good. Well, last year, a lot of folks marked the 10-year anniversary of the ADA, and this was the it came about during the first Bush administration. I think some people felt that it maybe was one of the most important things that happened during that time. Now, 10 years on, what can you say about the Americans with Disabilities Act?
I think the Americans with Disabilities Act has given us some important tools that we as a community can use and are using. It has not fulfilled every promise or hope that the disability community had for it, I don't think. We still have significant problems, economic problems. The unemployment rate in the disability community has not changed very much since the ADA was signed, and it's still somewhere around 70%, which is quite high for any, it's much higher than any other group of people in the U.S. So in some areas, it has not fulfilled perhaps some of the dreams and hopes that people had. However, in other areas, it has made a really big difference. In terms of public accommodations, restaurants, movie theaters, stores, those kinds of things, it's given the disability community a tool, or you might say a weapon, to use against barriers and discrimination that we encounter in our everyday lives. The ADA has also been used in some very creative and important ways, I think, in terms of, for example, there was the Olmstead decision by the U.S. Supreme Court 2 years ago, which was a case that originated in Georgia, and the argument by the disabled plaintiffs was that they were institutionalized in order to receive support services that they required because of their disabilities, and they wanted to receive those same kinds of support services in their own homes so that they could remain part of the community, and that, in fact, by forcing them to go into an institution to get the services they need, in effect, their ADA rights were being violated because they were being forced into a segregated rather than an integrated setting. And the ADA clearly states that people with disabilities must be able to enjoy programs and services in the most integrated setting. And so the Olmstead decision was something I think a lot of people in the public didn't hear about. But for the disability community, some of us talk about it as our Brown versus the Board of Education decision, because it really establishes a fundamental right to be integrated in the community and to receive services there. So our community now is working on a state-by-state basis to try to get every state to understand what the Olmstead decision means and to start shifting resources away from institutions towards community support programs.
You talked a little bit ago about unemployment among the disabled community and how high it is. Is that primarily an issue of employers being unwilling to hire disabled people, or does it also have something to do with infrastructure so that access and having appropriate tools for people to do work, that's not there, and that perhaps employers are willing, but they face barriers in employing people who are disabled?
I think there's a number of factors that account for the high unemployment rate. I do think part of it is subtle forms and sometimes not so subtle forms of workplace discrimination, just a general discomfort with disability, feeling like, I don't know what this is going to mean for my other employees and for my company, so I just don't know if I want to take that step, you know. So there is some discrimination. There is also a lack of awareness among employers about what their responsibilities are towards employees with disabilities in terms of providing workplace accommodations. They don't understand how easy that usually is. They don't understand that perhaps by spending a little bit of money or even making modifications in the workplace that cost little or nothing, that they can make a very big difference in the ability of someone to perform a job just as well as anyone else. So there, a lot of employers really don't understand what kinds of accommodations are available and how to implement them. And then on the other side, I think in the disability community, there's a real fear of paid employment among some people, because we are in a situation still where a lot of the benefits that people depend on for really essential services, healthcare benefits like Medicaid, for instance, still do largely depend upon a declaration of poverty and inability to work. Medicaid, for a lot of people with disabilities, provides things that they have to have in order to live independently, such as daily personal assistance services, ongoing prescription medications, durable medical equipment like wheelchairs. And these are things that your average employee health policy does not cover, and so it can't be replaced by, you know, getting a good job even. And so a lot of people are understandably reluctant to trade in services that are essential to their lives and well-being for even for a very good job. Now, there's been a lot of advocacy by the disability community in recent years to create what we call work incentives or to eliminate work disincentives within the benefit structure so that now there are some programs whereby an individual can accept a job and earn a paycheck, and under certain circumstances, they can retain the benefits that they need to have. And I'm not talking so much about cash benefits, but again, the health care and support services that is not available to them through the employer health plan. And so some things are improving in that regard, but I think it's still a pretty major factor in our unemployment rate.
Maybe at this point I should introduce again our guest for this part of Focus 580. We're speaking with Laura Hershey. She is a disability rights activist and journalist. She's a published writer and poet. She works as a consultant with different organizations who are interested in improving their efforts to serve people with disabilities. She currently is spending some time as a guest in residence at Unit 1 on the U of I campus. And maybe I would mention that she also writes a regular web column about disability issues, and that you can, if you have access to the internet, you can go to her webpage and see some of her poetry, read some of her web columns, some longer articles, and because the address is rather long, probably the easiest way to find her is to pick your favorite browser and just put her name in. That's the way I did it. Laura Hershey, spelled H-E-R-S-H-E-Y. And you can have an opportunity there to read some of her writing. And, of course, questions are welcome here, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Yesterday, President Bush announced something, and he made a proposal, and actually he apparently had talked about this during the campaign as well, a proposal for something that he called the New Freedom Initiative, which is a plan that over 5 years would provide a little over $1 billion to do things like increase research funding for assistive technologies, would provide money for low-interest loans so disabled people could buy computers and other equipment so they could work at home, also put some money into transportation, increasing transportation for people who have special needs. I wonder how much you know about this and what you think about it.
Well, of course, you know, I followed all the both candidates or all candidates' statements during the campaign, and George W. Bush does seem to be now talking about, again, some of the ideas that he put forward during the campaign. I'm all for assistive technology as part of the solution to these problems we've been talking about, unemployment and institutionalization and things like that. It certainly is not the only solution. It's kind of, you know, people get excited about assistive technology because it's technology. It's, you know, it's neat. It's fun to see how it works. It's exciting to think that somebody can do something independently using a special computer or something like that. And it is there's a great deal of promise, and in fact, already people are using assistive technology and making really big differences in their lives and their opportunities. Transportation is also really important. I think I would, at this point, I'm kind of reserving judgment on the Bush administration's commitment to the disability community, and I say that partly because of his record in Texas, which is not so good. In fact, it's kind of timely right now, and this has not made a lot of media attention, but starting next week, there are 9 people with disabilities down in Austin, Texas, who are going to be serving a jail sentence during next week. They were arrested a little over a year ago at the governor's mansion in Austin because they were protesting against Governor Bush, his lack of commitment to implementing the decision I was talking about a few minutes ago, the Olmstead decision, and his lack of commitment to increasing support programs in the community for people so that they don't have to be institutionalized. And in fact, I believe Texas was one of the states that signed on to an amicus brief in the Supreme Court opposing the community integration mandate of the Olmstead decision. So he doesn't have a great record for representing our interests. And, you know, I think it's important for people to be aware that these nine individuals are going to be sitting in a jail cell next week because Governor Bush chose, rather than to acknowledge the issues raised by these protesters, he chose instead to have them arrested and that they were convicted, and they'll be serving up to a week in jail for that.
We have a caller to bring into the conversation, and of course anyone who's listening is welcome to call with question or comment here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Also, we have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, around Illinois or Indiana, any place the signal will travel, 800-222-9455. We'll start here with someone in Champaign, and it's line number one. Hello.
Hello. I'm calling because I'm curious. You keep talking about the disability community. Well, I've had a disability for, I don't know, 55 years, and my impression is that people with disabilities are, by and large, not a community, not united. The only thing in common you can point to is some sort of disability. Otherwise, they're all over the religious and political spectrum. So I'm wondering to what extent this community you're talking about even actually exists.
That's a good question. The disability community is extremely diverse. He's absolutely right. It's the one minority group that crosses over every single other demographic group in society, politically, racially, gender, class. Extremely diverse. And partly as a result of that, we haven't been very united for many years. I think another factor that has kept people with disabilities divided for years was the fact that the systems that were set up to provide services or, you know, in other ways, serve the communities were all divided up by diagnosis. So you had one organization to serve blind people, one organization to represent people with hearing impairments, another one to represent people who are spinal cord injured. All these different, you know, small constituencies, often not paying attention to each other and joining in with each other in any kind of a coordinated advocacy effort.
Not only do they not coordinate, sometimes they're in direct conflict. For example, the mainstreaming of students into mainstream classrooms is not uniformly desired by all of the different groups you're talking about. I'm thinking here, for example, of the deaf community, which is not uniformly united in saying, we want all our deaf students in mainstream classrooms.
Yeah, and I think on that issue, part of the reason is that schools have done a very bad job of integrating deaf students in such a way that they're still able to learn in their primary language of American Sign Language. And, you know, there's just been a lot of failures because this is true of a lot of different people with all kinds of disabilities. The inclusion process is a good idea that has been done poorly in many instances, and it sort of turned people against the idea. But what I was going to say is that I think that in terms of at least political unity, I do think things are changing. We've talked about the Americans with Disabilities Act, which became law in 1990, and that was really a very coordinated, united effort. There was a lot of solidarity among all different kinds of groups, all kinds of disabilities, all kinds of political persuasions. You know, the disability organizations that represent, that usually stay pretty narrowly focused on their agenda, really came together and worked together. And if they hadn't, we wouldn't have the ADA. And in fact, there were several times when opponents of the ADA tried to undermine it, weaken it, when it was going through Congress by carving out one group or another to say, you know, this group shouldn't be protected. People with AIDS and HIV in particular, there were efforts by some very conservative senators to say, you know, people with this particular disability, AIDS should not be protected under this law. And everyone held firm and said, this law has got to include all people with disabilities. I also think the independent living movement has brought a lot of people together in cross-disability activism, not everywhere and not perfectly, but more and more you're finding that, you know, local independent living centers and statewide advocacy groups and so forth, both the membership and the leadership really represent a variety of disabilities and a variety of, other kinds of demographic breakdowns. The other day I went to visit the PACE Center in Urbana, which is the local independent living and advocacy group here, and I spoke to the staff, and there were people using wheelchairs, there were people using crutches, there were two deaf people, there were people with vision impairments, and this was out of a small staff of about 12 or 14 people. So I do think that we are developing more cooperation and more unity. And, you know, sometimes you're right, we do work at cross purposes. I think that's the nature of a diverse community with people who have a lot of strong opinions. And it's not good when it sabotages our efforts, but when it causes us to challenge each other and learn from each other, then I think it is good.
Let's talk with someone else. This next caller is in Joliet and on line number 4. Hello.
Thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question and a comment. In the 60s, I demonstrated down south for the segregation issues, and I was thrown in jail more than a couple of times. And later on in life, I became a police officer. And normally, no one gets arrested for demonstrating, as you said, what happened in Texas. Normally, you get arrested for doing something illegal while you're demonstrating. And I was just wondering what exactly they were charged with. And then secondly, my father was a disabled man, and boy, sometimes he could be a real mean cuss. And sometimes people get a notion that disabled people can't get in trouble and can't cause a ruckus. And I would just like if you could address again the issue of the people being put in jail in Texas for demonstrating, because I think maybe you presented it in the wrong light. Thank you.
No, I don't think so. They certainly were doing civil disobedience. And I'm not trying to say that, you know, they didn't know what they were doing or they didn't want to take that risk. My point in telling about the Bush Nine, as we're calling them, is that, you know, the reasons why they were doing that is that Bush, then-Governor Bush, was actively opposing the community integration and civil rights of people with disabilities. And with that demonstration, maybe he would have had an opportunity to change his position And he didn't. Instead, he chose to, you know, have people arrested again.
I'm not arguing with your approach and your cause. What I'm saying is that I know when I was heading down to Alabama and Georgia, my intention was to be arrested.
Sure.
And
yeah.
So to say that he just arbitrarily arrested these people.
I didn't say arbitrarily, but he did have a choice between moving in a direction that would be supportive of the rights of people with disabilities to live in the community. You know, now understand, these nine people chose to do civil disobedience. They got arrested. They understood that that was a possible consequence. But in Texas, and indeed across the United States, there's 1.9 million people living in nursing homes. Now, those people didn't do anything illegal, and yet they are just as confined. In fact, if I had a choice between being one of the Bush Nine, you know, one of these people down there that's getting ready to spend a week in jail, or being one of those 1.9 million people in a nursing home, you bet I would take the jail sentence, because when you're in jail, you know that you're going to get out. You know what your sentence is. And with institutions that confine people with disabilities, that's usually a life sentence. And again, those people did not choose to violate the law. They did not do anything to deserve their captivity. And I think that is part of, you know, at least symbolically, one of the reasons why many of us in the disability community have done civil disobedience around this issue.
Well, do you explain that better this time? Because I agree wholeheartedly in your cause, and you might be 100% right, but initially you gave the impression that saying that they were out there committing civil disobedience with the idea of probably being arrested, that makes it more clear. Thank you very much.
Sure. And, you know, the civil disobedience that the disability rights movement has done, often it does result in some of us being arrested. Usually the protesters have been released after a few hours to a day or two. And there's several reasons for that, I think. One is that, in general, jails don't like to try to accommodate a lot of disabled people. It's, you know, they're not set up, just like a lot of society. They still have barriers, and they don't have the right infrastructure. So, but yeah, I didn't mean to say that these protesters were, you know, naive or somehow, you know, victims that didn't know what they were getting into. They're, in fact, I think they're heroes because they're doing this to defend the rights of all people with disabilities to live in the community instead of being imprisoned in institutions.
What, now I'm curious, what was it that these people were charged with?
I'm not sure what the exact charge is. Usually with a situation like this, it's something like trespassing or obstruction. You know, anybody that's done civil disobedience around other issues may, you know, have some idea about this. Tactically, it's pretty different when the protesters are people with disabilities. But it's, you know, again, I don't know what the exact charge was in that case, but usually it's something like obstruction.
Yeah. Well, we're past our midpoint here. I guess I should introduce again our guest. We're talking with Laura Hershey. She is a published writer and poet. She has a number of years' experience working professionally in the fields of disability rights and also in journalism. She is now visiting the campus of the University of Illinois, spending some time as guest in residence at Unit 1 on the U of I campus. And is talking with us this morning from there. And questions, comments, of course, are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. And I do want to mention again that if you're interested in reading some of her writing, either some examples of her regular web column, some longer pieces, some poetry. You can find all of those on her webpage, and probably the easiest way to find that is just go to your favorite browser and put her name in, Laura Hershey, last name spelled H-E-R-S-H-E-Y, and you should be able to find it. You can look at it there. And questions, again, are welcome. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. I was looking at some of your Crip commentaries, and one that really struck me, it was one that you wrote last year, but I think it applies because right now, again, because it has to do with the television series Survivor. And I was kind of tickled by it. You were talking about the way you felt about the show. The first line of the piece is, "I just found another reason to kill my television." And you went on to say, "Well, I probably won't," but it was this last summer's series of Survivor, and you talked about your response to it, and you write further on in the piece, you write, "Here in a nutshell is the message of the program, that is, the strength of a group depends on and justifies getting rid of its less powerful members." Do you think that indeed in society, in American society, that we have such a strong ethic like that, that somehow, even if we don't think about it, that this survival of the fittest idea is embedded in us, and that shapes the way we think about disability?
I think that's there. I hope it's not the predominant ethic in this society, but I think it's there, and it finds expression in programs like Survivor and in some of the political battles that we face, in the attitude that, you know, children with disabilities just don't belong in the regular classroom because somehow they're going to slow things down, or, you know, they're going to interfere with the education of the regular children. I do think there's that strain, and I think it's something that we have to bring out into the open so that we can criticize it and say, you know, in fact, this is not what makes a society better or stronger. This is what undermines a society when you start creating different categories of people that are expendable in one way or another, either by, you know, segregating them in institutions or in self-contained separate classrooms in schools, or, you know, just all the different ways that we sort of cut people loose, cut people off from our society. Does that answer your question?
Yes, I think it does. We have another caller. Let's talk with him. This is a person in Kankakee, line number 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Good morning.
Yes.
My question is concerning early intervention, children 0 to 3. And Governor Ryan has allegedly cut a lot of early intervention programs. And we, the consumers, have been notified that children who are born with disabilities will not receive intervention unless they show a 60% delay. And I'd like for her to comment on that.
Okay. I don't know very much at all about Illinois politics because I am from Colorado, but if what you're saying is true, which I'm sure it is, I think it's a very bad thing. You know, it's clear that children with disabilities do better if they get support services early on. Parents do better at meeting those children's need if they get resources and support early on. Creating an arbitrary cutoff line of, what was it, 60% delay?
That's correct.
That seems just like another way to, you know, to eliminate people from the services, people who need it. And that happens from time to time in various disability programs when one group or another wants to make budget cuts. They either decide, well, some people aren't disabled enough to get the service, or they'll decide some people are too disabled to get the service. And the way that they measure people is usually pretty arbitrary, too. So, you know, I'm just answering in a very general way since I don't know the details about the Illinois situation. But I think that all programs designed to serve people with disabilities and support us should be based on what that person needs, not on meeting a particular measure or a particular scale of impairment. I see this oftentimes too in eligibility criteria for in-home support services, at least back in Colorado where I'm from, that you have to prove to meet a certain level of disability. You don't just have to prove that you need home health services or personal assistance services in order to function in your home, but rather you have to prove that you are really, you know, you're more disabled than some arbitrary cutoff line.
Would you view it as an act of discrimination?
I think I would, in a way, because it discriminates against one group of children with disabilities. It's, you know, again, it's carving out a whole group of children who were formerly eligible for services, who obviously are disabled, who do have the needs, and it's saying these services are not available to those children.
Thank you.
All right, thank you for the call. Other questions, comments are certainly welcome. We have about 10 minutes left here in Champaign-Urbana. If you'd like to call, the number 333-9455. And we also have a toll-free line. That's good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. I recall some years now ago interviewing the author who'd written a book looking at the history of the movement for disability rights in the United States, talking about how disabled people often are pretty distressed at the kind of images of disabled people that one sees in popular media. And he said that it tended towards one of two kind of stereotypes. On the one hand, there was the poster child. And then on the other hand, it was the kind of person that he called the super crip, which was kind of like, you know, just to cite a ridiculous example, it's like, you know, the person with no legs that climbs Mount Everest. And that he says that people who are disabled are really distressed that those are the images that are offered. And not only does that give the wrong sort of really the wrong image of what disability is about, it also doesn't represent the kind of diversity that you see in the disabled community, and the fact that there are a lot of folks who just see themselves as sort of just plain folks and certainly aren't one or the other of those. Do you think that that's still an issue?
It's still very much an issue, and these two stereotypes get represented in all different kinds of ways. But I think what they speak to is the idea that a person with a disability is either really pitiful, just a hopeless case, and is eternally needy and unable to contribute, and that they're therefore objects of charity because of their personal misfortune. Or people with disabilities have no needs whatsoever. They're just, you know, they're just as able to do everything no matter what the environment, without any type of additional support. And both of these ideas really not only did they misrepresent us, but they really deny the reality of how we do live and what our needs are. In fact, for most people with disabilities, we do have needs related to our disabilities. Some people need accessibility ramps instead of stairs. Some people need sign language interpreting in order to communicate with others. Some people need modified work hours so that they can hold down a job given their stamina level. Some people need support services to assist them with daily living activities like dressing and bathing and keeping house. And in order to live in their own home, they need these kinds of things. And so most of us really do have some needs, and most of us also have a lot to contribute to society. We can not only take, we can give. We can, you know, contribute to our neighborhoods, our to the workplace, to our families, to political action, to volunteer action, all kinds of ways that people with disabilities can be important, valued, contributing members of society and still have needs that must be met. And so I think maybe it's harder for the, I don't know, for some in the media and for some in the public to get hold of the idea that, you know, you really may need to change some things about society. You can't just, you know, give somebody a really cool racing wheelchair and they're going to be just fine. You don't have to build ramps because, after all, they can climb a mountain. You know, I think it's harder but more important to recognize that the environment will need to be modified, that supports will need to be available in order for us to make the contributions that we have to make, and we really do. So, you know, we're not the poster child because we have a lot to offer, and we're not the super crit because, you know, disability means that an inaccessible, unsupportive environment needs to be changed to become accessible and supportive.
You mentioned in response to an earlier call the fact that you live in Colorado. And one of the commentaries that I looked at that's on your website, it talks about the fact that you always look forward to the Denver International Film Festival. And you talked about a couple of movies that you saw, and this was a commentary from the fall of 1999, where you talk about one that you thought was good and one that wasn't. And I'm just curious if you might talk a little bit about what you see in popular media, and whether, in fact, you think there are some examples that you would really point to as saying that you liked or that there were some important points made about disability, some things that really, to you, stand out.
Mm-hmm. I think there have been some really good independent films. And, of course, these are harder for people to find or to see. Here on campus, the other night, we watched a film called When Billy Broke His Head and Other Tales of Wonder. It's a documentary made by a filmmaker in Minnesota who has a brain injury. And it's kind of his personal odyssey of going around the country and meeting various activists and also confronting some of the issues that face the disability community. It's very well done. It's very funny in parts, and it's you know, it really helps people understand, I think, what the community is about. So that's one, but that's pretty hard to get a hold of. It can be obtained through a magazine called Mouth, which is based in Topeka. And other than that, I don't have their address committed to memory. Hmm. I think in the more mainstream media, you know, there's good and bad. And I'm trying to think of some precise examples. Maybe some people that call in will be able to think of some. But I think, in general, what you see is, you know, occasionally someone with a disability just in the movie as a regular character, and that's great because, you know, we need to be visible. We need to be seen in all types of walks of life and all activities. And it seems very natural, you know, when someone's just there as a coworker or a neighbor or whatever. Other times there's, you know, some pretty, I guess you'd say, insulting images put forward that, you know, that people with disabilities are a certain way. They're either really whiny or really, I don't know, just, you know, just various stereotypes that, that show us as being really not fully human. And I'm sorry, I can't think of any examples. And I do study this a lot. I mean, I'm fascinated by media images, but...
Well, I imagine what that says in part is that there aren't many images of disabled people, probably one way or the other.
Well, you know, in fact, there are a lot. It's like in a lot of the big blockbuster movies, somebody did a little study informally once about winners of the Best Actor Academy Award.
Uh-huh.
And for like the last 20 years, I think about half or maybe even more of the winners of that particular award were non-disabled men playing men with disabilities, playing, you know, characters with a disability.
Mm-hmm.
Examples would be Dustin Hoffman as Rain Man.
Al Pacino in Scent of a Woman. Yeah.
And Tom Cruise in Born on the 4th of July. Daniel Day-Lewis in My Left Foot.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say that each of these movies, in terms of portrayal of disability, had some really good things and some really negative things. Like, for instance, with Rain Man, I think Dustin Hoffman did a really good job of portraying a person with autism. And I think it was a very well-written story and all that. Where I was really disappointed in the movie was at the very end, because he's, you know, his brother wants to get him out of the institution, so the brother brings him home to live with him, but he finds that, you know, he can't single-handedly meet all of the support needs that his brother has.
Hmm.
And so the only option that's shown is to send him back to the institution. There's never any discussion of, you know, the kinds of services and supports that, in fact, many adults with autism and other disabilities use to live independently.
You know,
it doesn't have to be met by a single family member. There are programs and resources that could, you know, support someone in the community.
Yeah. We're at the end of our time. In fact, I'm past, so I'm afraid we're going to have to stop. But I want to say thanks very much for giving us some time, and we appreciate you talking with us.
Thank you.
Our guest, Laura Hershey, she's a disability rights activist and journalist, currently spending some time as guest in residence at Allen Hall on U of I campus.